From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. The fight over the death penalty continues to unfold in Arkansas today. It was sparked by the state's plan to execute 8 men over the span of just 11 days, all by the end of this month. The state was dealt several legal setbacks yesterday, including a ruling that blocks the state from using one drug involved in the executions. So Arkansas Attorney General is appealing today, and at least one inmate is waiting to hear whether he lives or dies as scheduled tonight. Let's bring in Janelle Lilly, anchor and reporter at KATV Channel 7, the ABC News affiliate in Little Rock. And Janelle, first of all, bring us up to speed on what happened in court yesterday regarding one of these drugs.
Well, what happened yesterday in court is the judge issued an oral restraining order, basically speaking and saying that she would today issue the written restraining order on the use of these drugs. Now, this is really bad for the state because this restraining order actually says they can't use or in any way the drugs. So they can't even mix the cocktails ahead of the planned execution tonight for the lethal injection.
So this would then presumably have an effect on all of the executions that were planned.
It does. It means every single execution that's planned cannot at this moment go forward.
Okay. So remind us, was it the drug companies or the distributors that had brought the case against the state claiming that they were misled when the state of Arkansas purchased them?
Yeah, the state of Arkansas, we learned in court yesterday, never told the drug manufacturer that the drug would be used for executions. In fact, the deputy director testified that he specifically left that out. The judge ruled that the state had acted in bad faith by not disclosing that information.
Okay. But I understand, though, that as mentioned, the Arkansas Attorney General is appealing this ruling.
Yeah, just before noon our time, the attorney general filed her written appeal to the state Supreme Court. So that means she's really on a time crunch here. Up until that written order came down, her hands were tied. She couldn't do anything. And so now she has just a matter of a few hours to get that appeal ready. The state Supreme Court can either decide to uphold the injunction or they can rule against it, in which case at least one of the inmates, Liddell Lee, would be executed tonight.
Okay. Now, yesterday, though, another inmate, convicted murderer Stacey Johnson, received a stay of execution.
He did. He received that stay from the Arkansas State Supreme Court.
Okay. And what was the basis of that stay, of that decision?
Well, the state Supreme Court felt that the DNA evidence at the time, the technology wasn't there. So they went ahead and stayed that order. Although, to be clear, they didn't issue a full opinion. They just wrote the order. So we're not exactly sure what went into all of that. But here's the catch. The attorney general could appeal that order to the United States Supreme Court, which is exactly what she did on Monday. The Supreme Court weighed in probably 12, 13 minutes before the death warrant was going to expire and upheld the lower court, the state Supreme Court's ruling. And that meant we didn't have executions going forward. We could be in for the same kind of drama tonight.
Right. So the Supreme Court decided not to hear the case and let the lower court ruling stand.
Okay. That's exactly right.
So much going on here. Let's take a step back for a second, Janelle, and remind us why the state of Arkansas initially said that they wanted to carry out these 8 executions in such a short period of time.
Well, it really comes down to this drug called midazolam. That's the first drug. It's the sedative that's supposed to allow the person to go to sleep or become unconscious when the other drugs are administered. That's going to expire at the end of the month. That's why all of these executions needed to go forward before the drug expired.
Okay. So many changes happening moment from moment. How is all of this resonating amongst people in Arkansas?
You know, that's a great question. And I think that's the thing that people are really missing. You know, everything's changing so fast. You're so busy reporting the news. What we're forgetting is the people of Arkansas. And I, from just anecdotally, the folks on the street are very frustrated with the courts. In fact, we had a state senator tweet out the cell phone number of our chief justice because folks are just so angry and they were presumably calling him and he wanted them to call the chief justice. So his cell phone number is now public knowledge. I don't know if he's getting a lot of calls. If I were him, I'd probably turn it off. But the number of comments we're getting on our Facebook pages and Twitter, folks are just really frustrated at the back and forth nature of this and just the intervention by the courts.
Okay. And we should note that judges are elected in Arkansas?
Yes, judges are elected in Arkansas.
Okay. Wow. So much going on here. That's Janelle Lilly, anchor and reporter at KATV Channel 7, the ABC News affiliate in Little Rock, Arkansas, bringing us up to speed on the numerous legal challenges that have come up against Arkansas's plan to execute 8 men over the span of just 11 days. They had planned to do it by the end of this month. Janelle, thank you so very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, it was 3 years ago next week that Flint, Michigan decided to form a new water district and stop buying water from Detroit, which led, as we know, to the water crisis in Flint, lead in the drinking water, poisoned hundreds of children. And since then, attention has focused on the nation's regulations for lead. The Environmental Protection Agency implemented the lead and copper rule in 1991 and is now considering an update. But some experts fear that proposed changes could actually weaken protections for public health. Julie Grant from Here and Now contributor The Allegheny Front reports.
The intention of the federal lead rule is to protect public health. To find out how well it works, we asked Mark Edwards. He's a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Virginia Tech and helped expose Flint's lead problem.
Current EPA lead and copper rule has become a sick joke on the American people.
He says you only need to look at Flint to understand why.
You had a water crisis. You had the National Guard distributing bottled water, putting filters on taps, warnings, neighborhoods of children with elevated blood lead. And the city was officially meeting the lead and copper rule according to the EPA and the state.
How could a community with such high lead levels not have violated the regulation meant to prevent lead in the water? Well, under the current rule, water utilities are supposed to test tap water at homes it considers high risk for lead every few years. If it finds enough with elevated concentrations, the utility is supposed to take action. That could mean adjusting corrosion control chemicals at the water treatment plant or starting a program to replace water service lines made of lead. But that's expensive, says Edward. So many utilities, like Flint, use testing methods that go around the rule.
It really became easier to cheat for water utilities than to meet the intent of the rule. And EPA has effectively condoned cheating for at least the last 12 years.
The Guardian newspaper last year identified 33 cities that use those cheats or loopholes. They found that Boston, Detroit, Chicago, and Philadelphia all do things like instruct residents to pre-flush the tap or remove aerators from the faucet before testing the water. These techniques can hide lead contamination. In Philadelphia, a class action lawsuit was filed on behalf of residents last summer accusing that city of cheating. And in Flint,
we are announcing charges against four individuals.
In December, Michigan filed criminal charges against local and state officials, in part for hiding elevated lead levels from residents. But even before the crisis in Flint, an EPA working group with representatives from water utilities, public health departments, and others, including Tom Neltner, chemicals policy director at the Environmental Defense Fund, was tasked with overhauling the lead in water rule. In 2015, the group came out with a set of recommendations. Neltner says they focused on replacing all the lead service lines throughout the country. Those are the pipes that connect the main water line that runs along your street into your home.
Well, we basically said that the current system makes lead service line the last resort. You only do it after corrosion controls failed and nothing else is working. What we said is you need to start now. That right up front, you need to have a program to get these lines replaced.
The American Water Works Association, which represents the industry, endorsed this recommendation. Most older cities are rife with lead service lines. There are millions of them throughout the country. Replacing them could take 30 years and likely much longer. But some experts say this still won't solve the problem in many homes.
Well, that won't do very much because most of the lead in people's drinking water isn't coming from lead service pipes. It's coming from the plumbing in their house.
Joel Schwartz is an environmental epidemiologist at the Harvard School of Public Health. He says many homes, even if they don't have lead service lines, still have lead in the solder that connects the pipes, in valves and faucets. So he prefers the alternate method, using chemicals to prevent lead corrosion in plumbing.
Corrosion control helps everywhere and is a lot cheaper.
When the city changed its water supply in Flint, officials did not use corrosion treatment. And in a study published this year, Mark Edwards' team found that the walls of water pipes made of galvanized iron actually contained some lead. It was from pipes elsewhere in the system. And without corrosion control chemicals, that lead showed up in the tap water.
Corrosion control is a very important band-aid. What it does, it forms a coating on these pipes, and it can reduce the amount of lead that leaches into the water. And this is a very good thing.
Edwards wants to see lead service lines replaced around the country, but he says even if there's money to do that in the coming decades, and that's a big if, the lead and copper rule will still need more focus on corrosion control and other short-term fixes. Meanwhile, the EPA is expected to draft a new lead and copper rule later this year. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant.
And a program note, we'll be taking the show south of the border next week, broadcasting from Mexico City Wednesday and Thursday. We'll be talking immigration, trade, and Mexico's changing relationship with the United States. Also, maybe a little art and food. That's next week on Here and Now. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson had more tough language for Iran today after announcing this week that the Iran nuclear deal is under review. It's just one of many foreign policy challenges facing the Trump administration. And joining us now to talk about them is Sir John Sars, who is the former head of the British Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. He's now chairman of the consulting firm Macro Advisory Partners. Sir John Sars, welcome back to Here and Now.
No, thank you, Jeremy. Nice to be back.
And let's start with Iran. The U.S. Secretary of State has accused Iran now of alarming ongoing provocations aimed at destabilizing the Middle East and undermining America's interests. But the U.S. also says that Iran is complying with the nuclear deal. What do you think is true?
Well, I think both things are true. I think the trigger for this statement was the need to roll over the sanctions exemptions that the administration have to do. They didn't want it to look as though they'd given up on an Iran policy and of being critical about the nuclear agreement. I think the nuclear agreement is worth keeping. It's an important, though not perfect, way of getting Iran to desist from developing nuclear weapons. But just because the nuclear issues, we have some assurance on them, it doesn't mean that Iranian behavior is acceptable. We're seeing across the Middle East the Iranians undermining the security of countries, whether it's Yemen or Bahrain, and propping up regimes like the one in Damascus. So there are genuine serious concerns about Iran's behavior in the region.
Do you think that the nuclear deal will be kept based on what you're hearing?
Well, it's hard to predict the decisions of the U.S. administration. I think they're still bedding down. They're still working out what to think on major issues. From my perspective, I was involved in the early stages of negotiating that deal when we first began that process with Iran back in 2003 and was involved up until 2009. I think it's a deal that's worth having. My main criticism of it is that the timelines are too short. They should be longer than they are at the moment. But I think it would be certainly in America's interests and the wider international interest to keep the agreement in place whilst ensuring that it's being implemented rigorously on the Iranian side.
And what about with North Korea and what has been happening there? A ship from the U.S. was supposedly heading in the direction, and then it turned out that that was not the case. People questioning the credibility of the Trump administration based on that, but also just increasing rhetoric between North Korea and the United States.
Well, I think the deployment of the ship was a bit of a snafu between the Pentagon and the White House, and these things occasionally happen. The most important point in here is that North Korea poses a very real threat to its neighbors, especially South Korea and Japan, and soon will be able to pose a direct nuclear threat to the United States. So the contrast with Iran is interesting. Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons, and we need to keep it that way. When a country acquires nuclear weapons, as North Korea has, well, the calculations are a lot more complicated, and the judgments that have to be made are a whole lot more difficult.
Do you think North Korea would ever actually use its nuclear weapons?
Well, you can't be sure the answer to that question. And frankly, the most dangerous time for that scenario would be if the Kim Jong-un regime felt that they were under threat and they were about to collapse, and then their behavior would be completely unpredictable. I think the right way forward on this is to build up the pressure on North Korea, and we're seeing that being done, and also engage very intensively and probably quite discreetly with the Chinese authorities. At the moment, Chinese goals and US goals don't overlap, apart from the issue of removing nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula. But I don't think either side have really tested the limits of what can be agreed between the two of them. And frankly, a Chinese orchestrated change of regime in Pyongyang, in the North Korean capital, would be a whole lot better for the world than a military strike by the United States.
Do you believe Chinese officials when they say, look, we're doing everything we can, there's nothing more that we could do to pressure North Korea?
Well, no, I don't think that is true. I have a lot of respect for the Chinese. I think the Chinese government system is very effectively administered in China's interests. They will need to take some very difficult decisions if they're to resolve the problems in North Korea on behalf of the international community. I think the only requirement for the international community is that this madman in Pyongyang, Kim Jong-un, no longer threatens the world with his nuclear weapons. And I think if the Chinese can focus on that challenge, then we might have some space for common ground.
What do you think of the idea of a preemptive strike by the United States on North Korea?
Well, I think that is fraught with difficulty because the North Korean nuclear weapons and missiles are buried underground. There are long systems of tunnels, networks of tunnels, and the U.S. military, however good the intelligence coverage, can't be confident that be able to take out the entire capability. And as soon as military action started, then there'd be a North Korean response against the South Korean capital, Seoul, and you'd have tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands, people killed in the exchanges. So it is very much a last resort. It does have to be an option for US policy, but it is certainly not the best way forward. The best way forward would be some form of consensual progress with the Chinese, which at the very least brings an end to the development of the nuclear missile programs, but in the long run has to remove them entirely from the Korean Peninsula.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Sir John Sars, who is the former head of the UK's Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. And since we last spoke, there was a terrorist attack where you are in London near Parliament last month that killed five people and injured 50. ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack, but the attacker was born in the UK. Is it possible to stop these kinds of attacks from happening?
Well, the short answer is not entirely. However capable the intelligence services and the security services in free countries in the West, you cannot monitor the activities of everyone who might pose a threat. I don't actually believe this was an ISIS-inspired and planned terrorist attack. It has more in common with the sort of individuals killing people that you have experience with this in the US, when they've got access to weaponry, or in this case a car which the perpetrator hired and just drove into crowds of people on Westminster Bridge. It's almost impossible. I think it is impossible to stop every one of those attacks. In a sense, the more complicated the attack, the greater the opportunities for security and intelligence services to find out about it and to disrupt it. But we're always going to have the threat of an individual, whether they're inspired by religious extremism or they've just got a grievance against society, carrying out these sorts of attacks. And in a sense, this is a price of freedom, that we have to be very vigilant against these attacks. But just occasionally, one or two of these will get through.
Do you think we're winning the fight against ISIS?
Well, certainly the operations in Syria and Iraq are closing down the space for ISIS. But the individuals there who survive, they will disperse and find other locations from which to operate. And I'm afraid not even military operations will kill the ideology. There has to be a process within the Islamic world which challenges and faces down the people who hold these very damaging extremist and violent views. And we're only really seeing the very beginnings of that process in the Islamic world. So we're going to have to deal with the existence of fundamentalist Islam, with an instinct to pursue their goals through violence. That's going to be a feature of the world for some years to come. We just have to equip ourselves to protect ourselves as best we can against it. I'm afraid military operations are not going to destroy it.
One more thing I have to ask you about, since you are a former intelligence official. What do you think about this investigation into Russian meddling in the U.S. election and whether there was coordination between the Russians and people close to Trump? Based on what you've seen at this point, what do you think?
I've not been in the intelligence community for 2.5 years, so I'm reliant mainly on what I read in the media. I think it's clear that the Russians did intervene in the US election. And I think that there's no doubt that the sort of software signature on the interventions could only have come from Russia. Now, there is an investigation underway by the FBI and by the Senate and I think House committees on intelligence into whether there were links with the Trump administration. And I don't have any inside information on that. I think the behavior of one or two people on the fringes do raise questions, but only the investigation by the FBI and the congressional committees will get to the bottom of it.
Did you ever, as an intelligence official, try to sway an election somewhere?
No, we didn't. Obviously, we work closely with foreign counterparts, and many of them in countries which weren't democratic. And our main emphasis there was trying to make sure that the way in which they behaved was compliant with our perception and of human rights and our values. So that was always a challenge. But no, I'm glad to say that the only election I've tried to persuade, tried to influence, is the one in this country. And I do that as a private citizen with my own vote.
That's Sir John Sars, the former head of MI6. He is now the chairman of Macro Advisory Partners. Thanks so much for joining us, as always.
Thank you, Jeremy. Much enjoyed it.
And NPR's Frank Langfitt will look at the rise of populism in French politics ahead of this weekend's elections. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered. This is Here and Now.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Despite some improvements, California cities still top the American Lung Association's air pollution list. The group's annual State of the Air report lists 8 California cities in its list of the 10 most affected by year-round pollution and 6 of the top 10 cities for short-term particle pollution. And when it comes to ozone pollution, Los Angeles is still the worst, despite a significant reduction compared to last year's numbers. Cities with the cleanest air include Burlington, Vermont, Fort Myers, Florida, and Honolulu, Hawaii. Paul Billings is a senior vice president for advocacy at the American Lung Association. He joins us from Washington. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, let's kind of start with something that seems contradictory in the report, because this year's report finds that there's been continued improvement in air quality, but that there's also been a continued increase in spikes in particle pollution. Can you explain what's happening there?
Yes, what the report shows is that the Clean Air Act is working. We've seen significant improvements for ozone and year-round particle pollution, but we're also seeing spikes in short-term particle pollution, which can be caused by wildfires, droughts, wood smoke, and we attribute a lot of that those spikes to climate change. We're seeing the evidence that warmer climates and drier conditions are creating the conditions where we can see high levels of short-term particle spikes, which can be lethal.
Oh, so tell us more about that. Like, what are the health effects or the health concerns about these spikes?
Particle pollution, these are the very fine particles that penetrate deep in the lungs and get past the body's natural defenses. They can cause coughing and wheezing and shortness of breath in healthy adults. For people with chronic diseases like asthma, it can trigger an attack that can send somebody to the emergency room. But they also are linked to premature death, because the particles penetrate into the cardiovascular system and are linked to a wide range of adverse health consequences, cardiovascular events.
And in addition, you found that 4 in 10 Americans, so 40% of the country, lives in a county with unhealthy ozone or particulate pollution. Is that right?
Yes. The report found that 125 million Americans live in these counties. So nearly 40% of us are breathing unhealthy air on far too many days throughout the year.
Okay, wow. So that's quite something. But California continues to be a particular challenge here. It's really a standout, and perhaps not in the best ways, in this report. Why does California continue to face such a significant overall pollution problem?
California continues to struggle with air pollution, but no state has done more to clean the air. California has a long history of aggressive efforts to reduce air pollution. The challenges in California are several. One, a lot of people live in California, nearly 40 million people. The topography of California, there are mountains that hold the air pollution in. So in the South Coast Basin around Los Angeles or in the Central Valley, the pollution is generated from cars and trucks and industrial activity. And then because of the mountains and then the weather moves in, there's inversions that hold this pollution in, sort of subjecting the public to these high air pollution episodes. We also know that in the years for this report, 2013 through 2015, California struggled with drought. So very dry conditions that led to wildfires. The burning creates the particles that then stay in the community and unfortunately are causing the adverse health effects for the people that live there.
Yeah. A little earlier you said that part of the long-term concern has to do with climate change and that that could continue to exacerbate this problem. The president of the Lung Association has said that air quality improvements that we have seen in the past many, many years are directly tied to the Clean Air Act. So do you have concerns that, you know, if the government chooses to relax regulations around air pollution and air quality, that that could exacerbate a problem?
Yes. What our report shows is still 125 million people are breathing dirty air. But we also show tremendous progress compared to last year's report that showed 166 million people. So the biggest improvement I think we've ever seen in the report in, from a year-to-year basis. But we attribute those benefits to the Clean Air Act, the cleanup of dirty power plants, the fleet turnover, newer vehicles replacing older, dirtier vehicles on the roads, improvements for pollution controls on industrial operations. All these things driven by the Clean Air Act have reduced the air pollution burden on the public. But we also know that the Clean Air Act requires strict enforcement and compliance. And we know that absent strict oversight, air pollution levels can come up. We also know that without the environmental cop on the beat, we will see cheating and noncompliance. Certainly the Volkswagen example with the diesel vehicles is a prime example of why you need strict enforcement.
Well, Paul Billings is Vice President for Advocacy at the American Lung Association. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, today is 420, the unofficial holiday for marijuana enthusiasts. And to mark the occasion, a new church that's all about pot opens in Denver. It's called the International Church of Cannabis. And as Corey Jones from Here and Now contributor Colorado Public Radio reports, it's raised questions about religious freedom and marijuana laws.
The floor creaks under Lee Malloy as he walks past rows of pews. He sits, pauses, and gazes up at the chapel ceiling filled with Technicolor triangles.
It is pretty much a full spectrum of very bright, vivid color, rainbow-like, and very inspirational.
This is the new International Church of Cannabis. Malloy co-founded it. Inside this 113-year-old brick church, a psychedelic mural covers the ceiling and walls. Geometric shapes form things like animal faces. This is the work of Spanish artist Okuda San Miguel.
The art is explained through meditation on the sacrament and finding your own meaning in it, and that's part of what the elevationist experience is.
Okay, so let's back up here. By sacrament, Malloy means using pot to have a spiritual experience. And when he says elevationists, well, that's what he and more than 30 other members of this congregation call themselves. But don't expect sermons or masses.
Elevationism is not about authoritarian hierarchy. It is not about claiming you know the mind of God and telling people what to think.
The church houses a religious nonprofit called Elevation Ministries, and its founders have built their lives around weed. In 2014, they advocated for legal medical marijuana in Florida. That amendment failed, so they headed to Denver. They also have a company that promotes cannabis-related businesses. But Malloy says this church isn't about profit.
This is not a money-making venture in and of itself. It is genuinely a community project to set up a community church here in Denver.
At first, organizers hoped to make the church open to the public, but after neighbors and city officials raised concerns that the church was a front for a social pot club, it's now members only. This comes at a time when Colorado lawmakers have been trying to define rules and regulations around pot use in public. State Representative Dan Pabon, a Democrat from Denver, addressed the church during a floor debate last week.
I've talked to those folks who regulate these clubs in the city, and I've looked at the First Amendment and religious exemptions for the same. What they're doing seems patently illegal.
Last year, Denver voters approved public use of marijuana in permitted businesses. Details are still in the works. The city won't shut down the church as long as events stay private, says Dan Rowland. He's a spokesperson for Denver's Department of Excise and Licenses.
Marijuana consumption as a sacrament or some sort of religious rite does not prohibit the city from enforcing its valid and neutral laws against open and public consumption of marijuana.
Rowland says the church can't grow, sell, or distribute marijuana either. Over time, religions have used different methods to achieve altered states, like fasting.
And for some traditions, drugs have been a way to bring about that altered state, to open oneself to the Spirit.
That's Jeffrey Mahan. He's a professor of ministry, media, and culture at Denver's Iliff School of Theology. Mahan points to peyote use by Native Americans and even churches in the 1960s that used psychedelic drugs like LSD. Mahan says these days there's a spiritual hunger that he believes is driven partly by the digital age. He says that makes religious identities, like at Denver's Cannabis Church, more fluid.
People taking on religion as more personal projects and new religious movements. And I think you have to think about this as an example of that kind of religious experimentation.
International Church of Cannabis co-founder Lee Malloy says he's frustrated by fears that this is a nightclub or a scam. Malloy says the Elevationists plan to do community service and to be good neighbors. After all, the purpose of a modern-day church, he says, centers around community. For Here and Now, I'm Corey Jones in Denver.
A new study sheds light on how women are treated at one very high-profile workplace, the Supreme Court. Researchers at Northwestern University found that male Supreme Court justices interrupt female justices three times as often as they interrupt each other. The study authors have written about their research in Harvard Business Review, and the review senior editor Kurt Nickisch joins us now. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
And first, we have an example of what this study is talking about. This is from a very high-profile affirmative action case in 2015 where the plaintiff's attorney, Bert Rhein, was facing questions from Justice Sotomayor.
If you don't consider race, the holistic percentage, whatever it is going to be virtually all white.
And that is incorrect.
Why?
And that is an assumption that has no basis in this record.
Well,
it's a stereotypical racist assumption. That's
it's
what it is.
It's not, because of
with
reality
all deference,
that Justice Alito wants to rely on. Let me finish my point.
We heard Chief Justice Roberts step in there. Kurt, how much more are female justices interrupted than male justices?
Yeah, besides going back and looking at all those transcripts, the researchers looked carefully at 3 years. So back in 1990, when there was just one woman justice, Sandra Day O'Connor, she was interrupted, times anybody was interrupted, 35.7% of the time it was directed at her. In 2002, when there were two justices, nearly half the interruptions were directed at those two women justices. And in 2015, when there were three women justices, so one-third of the court, two-thirds of the interruptions were directed
at
them.
And how does this translate into other professions, people who don't find themselves on the Supreme Court? Do women get interrupted more than men?
There are women across the country listening right now, nodding their heads. They know this instinctually, but the research bears this out. Women get talked over much more than men in all sorts of settings. So that's partly due to unconscious bias, cultural reasons. And research also shows that a lot of this has to do with just the sense of control. So if you feel like you're in power, then you kind of dominate the conversation, or you feel empowered to interrupt other people. What's troubling here is that these are very powerful women. They're on the highest court in the land, and they're still getting stepped on.
What's the impact of this?
Well, one of the impacts here, where there are these very important cases being decided, is that just the views of these women are not being considered as much because they're getting cut off.
And at this point, all of the women on the court are liberal.
Yeah, they're liberal, and it turns out that liberals do get interrupted twice as often as by conservatives than the other way around. That's probably also a reflection of power because conservatives have had the majority on the court. But gender is actually the much more significant factor.
Now, we have a new justice on the court, Neil Gorsuch, and it sounds like he may fit in with this trend based on what he's done on lower courts.
Yeah, he also in his first, first oral arguments jumped in quite a bit. It's interesting also to look at the female justices on the court because they have adapted their behavior over time. They often started off saying more polite things like, can I ask? Or, you know, I wonder if, but they end up getting interrupted more. And so with time, they have become less polite and more direct in their questions.
That's Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. And we'll link you to more about this. It's fascinating at hereandnow.org. Kurt, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Tennis superstar Serena Williams posted a photo on Snapchat yesterday, posing in a bathing suit with the caption, 20 weeks. Well, a little number crunching points to the fact that Serena would have already been pregnant when she won the Australian Open in January. That got us wondering, how much exercise is safe during pregnancy? Well, a recent study in the Journal of the American Medical Association concluded that exercising, in most cases, is good for mothers and their fetuses. A researcher says it's important for everyone to get over this fear. So today, let's turn to Dr. Jessica Shepherd. She's an assistant professor of clinical obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois, Chicago. She joins us from Chicago. Dr. Shepherd, welcome.
Thank you. I really enjoy this program, and I'm excited to talk about this topic, especially since it's about Serena.
So tell us, first of all, Serena Williams is an elite athlete, but were you surprised that she, was probably pregnant when she won the Australian Open?
You know, when I compare it to maybe my pregnancy, knowing how tired I was, yes, I was surprised. But, you know, she is, again, an elite athlete. So that doesn't surprise me that she was able to accomplish that feat. But it's very impressive, I would say, at the least, that she was able to accomplish that without dropping a set, mind you.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the vast majority of the rest of us who are not elite athletes, I mean, let's talk about women and pregnancy and exercise. When it's recommended, I mean, how much are we talking about?
You know, in the past, we have associated physical exercise and pregnancy as something that we don't usually see together in the same sentence. But we do know, you know, through the American Congress of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, that we do have a recommendation that was updated in 2015 that physical activity, whether it's in pregnancy or out of pregnancy, absolutely improves our healthy lifestyle, but also cardiovascular and reduces the risk of obesity. So we now know that in pregnancy, this is something we really want to empower our women to do, and also that it's very beneficial for both mom and baby.
And so what kind of benefits can the fetus receive?
Yeah, so as you improve your cardiovascular ability for mom, that's going to increase the ability for baby to have the best nutrients, blood flow, oxygen, and decreasing the risk of obesity for mom, which essentially is going to decrease her risk of gestational diabetes and gestational hypertension, which can lead to effects such as preterm labor, larger babies, some difficulties with the actual delivery in increasing cesarean sections, and also for mom, postpartum, how is she going to recover? Physical activity definitely is going to improve that process postpartum.
And what kind of physical activity are we talking about? Because, of course, the universe of exercise is very large.
Yes, it is. And I feel that women should not feel that in pregnancy they need to significantly increase their physical activity and aerobic activity. But if they had been doing some type of activity prior to pregnancy, they can continue that. Although they need to discuss that with their obstetrician to make sure that sometimes adjustments need to be made. And also for women who are considered high risk in pregnancy, that there are some things that need to be adjusted, or physical activity may not be recommended for certain complications and conditions in pregnancy. So that needs to be discussed beforehand. But usually from an obstetrician perspective, we really want you to continue the physical activity that you did prior to pregnancy throughout pregnancy.
Really? So we're talking about anything, obviously running, cardio, cycling, rowing, basketball, weightlifting even?
Yes, weightlifting. I actually did a lot of weightlifting and training throughout pregnancy, and I found it to be very empowering, and it did help with my postpartum time frame. Now, there are certain activities and exercises that we don't recommend in pregnancy, and those are usually high-impact sports or group sports that may have some type of contact that could, again, potentially harm the baby and the mother, such as boxing, soccer, basketball.
Now, what about the various stages of pregnancy? I mean, are there times in which a woman may be more vulnerable to injury?
Yeah, during the third trimester, and obviously the reason is there is a larger baby, and so your abdominal risk of some type of contact and trauma to the baby is going to increase. Now, during first trimester, you know, that risk is going to be much lower because, you know, the fetus is much smaller, and the uterus is really protective at that point in time.
Now, you know, a little earlier we mentioned that a lot of people, and maybe culturally, we still sort of have this fear that pregnant women shouldn't be exercising. And I mean, I know we've all read reports and possibly even seen with our own eyes, or maybe have been these women who are, say, running marathons in their eighth or ninth month of pregnancy and, you know, getting all those judgy looks from folks.
There was a story, I think it was about 2 years ago. She had her baby 2 years ago. She was an Olympian runner, and she ran while pregnant. And she did get a lot of slack for running while pregnant, but she did very well. She's, again, an elite athlete. Her name is Alyssa Montano, and she sees the benefit of being able to, again, tell other women that they can do exercise in pregnancy. The real question is how much and what should you do? And again, discussing that with your doctor before you decide to take part in any physical activity during pregnancy.
Yeah, so always in consultation with your doctor. Dr. Jessica Shepherd is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois Chicago. She's also founder of Her Viewpoint, a website forum for women's health issues. Dr. Shepherd, thank you so very much.
Thank you, and I appreciate the time.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.